You're listening to audio from Grace Church, Miami. May you be challenged and encouraged by this message, having the affections of your heart stirred towards greater love and understanding of the person and work of Jesus Christ. If you'd like to check out more resources or donate to this ministry, please visit gracechurch.miami.
Possibilities and promises. That is how another year in front of us can feel like. Promises we make to ourselves or to others, resolutions, possibilities of what could be planned for and considered. Most of 2025, for me, in many respects, has been planned out. Now, I'll be the first to admit, I make plans. I don't always keep all of them. I trust I'm not the only person in this room who has that same testimony. But from sermons coming in the weeks and months ahead through 1 Peter, to thinking ahead to places like Clarity Camp, the summer youth camp that Grace Church Youth and many other churches go to in Central South Carolina at the end of June, and other places and plans, there are indeed all kinds of possibilities of what's ahead for us. I mean, just thinking about even for some of you in your own discipline as Christians and what you hope to do, some of you are already making plans to return to or to continue in a reading through the Bible in a year plan. I commend you for doing that. Others of you are going to do what some of us are going to do, which is to read through J.C. Ryle's expository thoughts on the Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, a few pages a day for 5 days a week of the next, I think it's like 47 weeks, and just reflecting on Jesus's teachings in the Gospels and how we could think about that. It's all kinds of possibilities of what we're thinking about in the years ahead. But it's not just simply in the years ahead or the months ahead or the weeks ahead, it's just the idea of anniversaries in general. The end of a year. Sometimes it's like this in marriage. We celebrate anniversaries. We've made it another year, hoping, praying, planning that we might make it another year in marriage for those of us who are married. For others, it's a celebration of a birthday. It's the reminder and that annual observation of the gift of life. For others, it's your class reunion. How many years has it been since you graduated kindergarten? I feel like we should be honoring that since we have these kindergarten graduations today. I've never quite understood that, while somehow we've kind of lowered the standards where we've gone from a college graduation to high school graduation and actually celebrating kindergarten graduation. Like, is it that hard these days that we're celebrating kindergarten graduation? That's a stressful event. I don't know. I mean, we have these class reunions. Can you imagine a class reunion of a bunch of fellow former kindergartners together? Telling that to your friends what's coming up. In May, I'm going to my class reunion. Oh, from high school? No, from kindergarten. That would be quite a response, I'm sure, from some of your friends. Maybe it's a year's work at a company. I know in today's age, many young adults trade companies and that they work for like they trade shoes. But others commit to a company and stay with it, and there's the benefits that come from that. Well, these anniversaries are markers. Memories are reflected upon them, and plans are made for more of them. Well, now with this new year of 2025 almost in front of us, today after all being December 29th, 2024, here's the question. What does it look like to look back at this last year and to look ahead to this coming year to assess and direct us? Well, to help orient this perspective, let me ask you to open your Bibles to 2 Corinthians. 2 Corinthians is the text I want us to be in. Now, for those of you who are new to the Bible, over 40 different authors writing over a span of 1,500 years in primarily two languages, Hebrew and Greek, with a spattering of Aramaic in there, with one central theme, because as Peter would say himself in 2 Peter, there are both human authors, but then there's also one divine author, orchestrating writing. Well, this is one such contribution. Paul, at one time a persecutor of Christians, he wasn't just a non-Christian, he was a hater of Christians. He would plan for their arrest, persecution, and potential death. And now, surprise of all surprise, not only has he put away those old ways, but he actually is being persecuted himself for being a Christian. And he spends then these latter years of his life living as a Christian and helping others come to know Christ, starting what we refer to today as planting churches and strengthening them through writing to them. And this letter to the 2 Corinthians is such an example of a church he spent time with, even as we heard earlier today in our reading from Heather. We saw that he was originally at the city in Corinth there as their pastor, their founding pastor, for a year and a half. And then God called him on to keep doing more work. But he would write them after having left being with them. And so 2 Corinthians is the second installment of this. Now, 2 Corinthians is really kind of dealing with all these attacks against Paul. Paul has definitely got a ministry that's not based on popularity. His popularity is like the weather. It changes quickly. And he knows it has to be built on something else. Describes his ministry in 2 Corinthians chapter 5 in the beginning of verses 1 and following. He talks about how he's alive here, living for the Lord, and yet desires to be with Christ in a similar way in Philippians 2. It says in verse 7, we walk by faith, not by sight. Verse 8, we would rather be away from the body and at home with the Lord. Yet, verse 9, we make it our aim to please him. He goes on to describe his ministry in verse 11, a ministry of reconciliation that's not unique to him and the other spiritual leaders, but common to all of them, as he describes the reality of this. And that takes us to our text this morning. Now, as we come to our text, verses 14 and 15, I want to come to this text by asking you two questions. And these questions will frame these two verses. Question number one, who loves you? Who loves you? Now, with that said, look at verse 14. Paul says, for the love of Christ controls us, because we have concluded this, that one has died for all, therefore all have died. And he died for all, that those who live might no longer live for themselves, but for him who for their sake died and was raised. Verse 14 brings us to that first question, who loves you? Friends, when you consider verse 14, I want you to consider verse 14 in light of your days ahead, because of what he has already done in your past, for those of you who are Christians. Verse 14 is a verse about perspective because of a person. Paul introduces to the Corinthians a perspective that we need to have ourselves as well. Look back at verse 14. He says, the love of Christ controls us. Paul is explaining here why he was devoted to service to God and service to the Corinthians. He's explaining what is the motivating reality here. Now, some people have asked the question in verse 14, what is the sort of understanding of this phrase, love of Christ? Is this a love for Christ? Is that what it means by love of Christ? Or is this a love from Christ, and that's what it means to have a love of Christ, or is it both? I think the context helps us. The context in verse 14 and then verse 15, you could say, is both. Look at verse 14. He talks about this love of Christ in verse 14. He says, because we have concluded this, what is it he's concluded? That one has died. Now watch how many times he says died in these two verses. He has died for all, therefore all have died. He has died for all, that those who live might not longer live for themselves, but for him who for their sake died and was raised. Four times in two verses, Paul keeps referring to Jesus's death. Jesus's death. The first orienting reality of here is that Jesus died for them. This is a remarkable statement. It's a remarkable statement because of why it's so compelling for Paul. Paul is grounding what he does and why he does it based upon what somebody else has done and why they have done it. It's not simply an example to imitate. It's good news to believe in that reorients Paul's entire life. Friends, you look at this again in verse 14. The love of Christ controls us. This idea of control means to hold together in the way that you think about putting your arms around something, or if you're to bind something, you think, for example, like a zip tie or duct tape. It's something that's binding something together that if you did not, it would go elsewhere. You think about like a dam that controls water. You think about a ditch that keeps things in their place. He's saying the love of Christ controls us. This is a sense of that it holds fast. This idea of both constraint and compulsion. It protects us and it directs us. It's both negative and positive. This love of Christ restrains us from being self-seeking, and it keeps us from selfish motives as we think about something else, someone else. Think about this dual notion here of constraint and restraint. It is controlling us. What I want you to see here is that it is the love of Christ that is keeping Paul from living for himself, and it causes Paul to pour out his life for others. Saying it differently, Paul is saying the gospel has saved me from an egocentricity to Christocentricity, meaning from being centered on myself to now being centered on Christ. And I am that way because of the love of Christ, which is what he goes back to here in verse 14 and again in verse 15. He died. He died. Verse 14, verse 15. You'll notice this phrase here. He has died for all. May I remind you of even what I read to you earlier in Romans chapter 10, the significance of this. Everyone who believes in him will not be put to shame, for there is no distinction between Jew and Greek, for the same Lord is Lord of all, bestowing his riches on all who call on him. There are not two different ways to be saved. There's not salvation for Jewish people, but not for non-Jewish people. He's saying, hey, there is salvation for all through Christ. This is not simply significant for an ethnic distinction, of which there is none, but also for a life reality to be reminded of. The central truth of the gospel is that Christ came to earth to become a man like us, that he might live in our place for us, and then die as a substitute on our behalf, resurrecting from the grave, that all those who believe in him, in his death, we would find life. Paul says, I don't just simply find that an interesting story. I find it a reorienting reality. It is a perspective-changing direction. It's the love of Christ. It controls us. Friends, what controls you? What motivates you? Let's go back, if I may, to goals, plans, priorities, promises, any other word I can come up with a P. What is your best version of you? What is the ideal picture that you would dream about? Perhaps it's financial security. Perhaps it's relational stability. Perhaps it's social activity. Perhaps it's personal beauty. are these things ultimate for you? How do you know if it's ultimate? Whether or not you accomplish them, whether or not you achieve them, determines whether or not your state of mind is settled and fixed and sure with things like hope, peace, joy. Reverse engineer, let's ask the question differently. Where do you place your greatest hope? What fuels your most consistent joy? What are you most consistently pursuing ambitiously for? Friends, I do not mean in any way to try to imply those things are at face value inherently wrong. Being financially secure is not wrong. Wanting to steward time and relationships and desiring to have goals and ambitions, not inherently wrong. But are they ultimate? I think what ends up happening a lot of times in life is there is this belief with your capacity and your autonomy and your personality that your goal in life has just become a better version of you. A little less of this, a little bit more of this. Paul had a different perspective altogether. And that's why I'm saying here in verse 14, this is about perspective because of a person, and that person was not Paul. It was Christ. That's why he says here in verse 14, for the love of Christ controls us. I think what's remarkable is he doesn't say the example of Christ, the presence of Christ, the accountability to Christ. He says the love of Christ. He's captivated not simply by what Jesus did, but why he did it. From the global reality of John 3:16, for God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten son that whoever believes in him would not perish but have everlasting life, to the personal reality of Galatians chapter 2, verse 20, where Paul says, I have been crucified with Christ. It is no longer I who live, but Christ who lives in me. And the life I live by faith in the Son of God who loved me and gave himself up for me, whether it be the global or the personal reality, it was the love of God in Christ that controlled Paul. I think what's helpful to be reminded here is that before we think about resolving of what to do, it's more, first of all, being reminded of what to remember. Verse 14 again. He died. He died. And how inclusive it is for all. There's no one in this room that does not qualify. No circumstance, no life event, no dark cave you've been living in, no criminal actions you've committed, no heinous, treasonous works that have been unseen by anyone except God who sees all that somehow disqualifies you. Christ's death is an invitation to believe in him. The only one who can atone for sin. So I go to that first question, who loves you, as a question of reflection. How does that compel you? Which takes us to our second question. First question is, who loves you? Second question is, whom do you live for? Look what Paul says in verse 15. He's continuing the thought here. He died for all. Why? That those who live, so notice the sort of word picture, death, life, that those who live might no longer live for themselves, but for him, who for their sake died and was raised. The second question is, whom do you live for? We think about the reality of this. This is about the pursuit of your life. If verse 14 is about perspective because of a person, this is about a pursuit. The perspective in verse 14, the pursuit in verse 15. That pursuit is, Why did he die? That those who live might no longer live for themselves, but for him. If I could boil it down, think of it like this. You have three options in life of who you can live for. And let's just go through them rather briefly, if I may. Number one, you can live for yourself. Number two, you can live for others. Number three, you can live for God in Christ. Option one, you can live for yourself. Option two, you can live for others. Option three, you can live for Christ. Let's consider those options. Living for yourself is sort of a me-first mindset. Now, you can come at this different ways. Some of it come at it very overtly selfish. Some of it come out of it kind of covertly selfish in this way. Overtly like, well, me first, kind of like it's my time, this is my life, this is my money, this is my career, this is my accomplishment. I really am as good as you think and even better. Other times, it's like, no, I'm thinking of me first, but in a kind of a perverse sort of way. I'm thinking of me because in order to think of you, I got to think about myself, me first, rather. And that's how sometimes counsel of the world goes today. You can't love others until you love yourself first. But the Bible, here's the key, the Bible assumes by default self-love. You think of an example of this in Ephesians chapter 5. Where Paul is talking to husbands, and he says, husbands, love your wives like Christ loved the church, for no one ever hated himself, but loved himself in church. He's like, listen, you get self-love. He's like, I'm working for husbands on that perspective, how to use that as a reference point. You provide for your needs. You might provide for them unwisely, foolishly rather, sinfully, corruptly, but yet you still focus on yourself. Living for yourself is a way that many people want to choose to live. But think about just logically, not even biblically, just logically. If you focus solely on yourself, this can lead to a lack of happiness and contentment, absence of fulfillment. This is why a lot of people would identify with a number of features to living for yourself. Number one, a lack of connection. We are inherently made by God to be social beings. Intended to be in relationships. The more we withdraw from relationships by our own decisions or disasters taking place in our life in the past, we will increasingly over time have a lack of connection. And therefore, when we need it, a lack of support. We'll also have a level of guilt and self-doubt. Constantly prioritizing ourselves over others can lead to this sense of guilt and doubt of the decision being made when you're faced with situations of, should I help another or should I help myself? What should I do? What I want to do versus what I'm being asked to do? It also creates a rather limited perspective. I'm reminded of Proverbs chapter 4, verse 7. It says, the beginning of wisdom is this, get wisdom. What's Proverbs saying there, or Solomon's teaching under the inspiration of the Holy Spirit, you are not the embodiment of all knowledge and wisdom. You have to seek out others. But for someone who lives for themselves, increasingly over time has a very inward perspective, limited in their understanding. It also creates a level of selfishness by which reorients the world around themselves. Strange relationships. You think about the reality of this. I don't know how many of you have ever heard of acromegaly. I had to look that word up. Acromegaly. It comes as a tumor on the pituitary gland. Your pituitary gland is this gland in your body that produces the growth hormone. And what ends up happening when you get this tumor is that your growth hormone of the pituitary gland becomes hyperactive. And you can see this non-cancerous tumor is being active on somebody because you'll see this abnormal growth in their hands or their feet or their facial features. It's causing this overproduction of a specific hormone. Now, this is what happens when people choose to live for themselves. It's not as if they should deny responsible care, food, sleep, exercising patterns and practices of wise stewardship of life. That's not the problem. It's when it has this hyperactive sort of spiritual pituitary gland where they give so much attention to themselves, they start having these sort of tumorous growths on their life where they have these overinflated areas of their life. And sometimes others of us see it, but they don't see it for themselves. That's what happens when you choose to live for yourself. And Paul says here in verse 15 that those who live might no longer live for themselves. Well, it takes us to our second option, which is to live for others. This seemingly is a better option, right? It's the idea of like loving your neighbor, right? It's like, okay, this idea of self-sacrifice, this idea of thinking of others. And there are many great examples of that. I could think about the reality of older adults who have elderly parents who need their adult children's care for them, financial provision for them. They need to drive them to the doctor's office. They need to check in on them, make sure they're taking their medication. They need to help them with their meals. They need to help them with some kind of daily rhythms and practices. There are some of you in this church that do that very thing for your elderly parents. That's an example of you caring for another. That's not wrong. That's good and right. But here becomes the problem. When you live for others with no other intention to simply do a virtuous act of care for another, it begs the question, why do you do it? Not what are you doing, but why do you do it? For some, it's seemingly a commendable desire to like pay back the elderly parent with what the parent once did for you when you were a child, to care for you when you couldn't care for yourself. And in that sense, you feel like you're kind of in a sense of debtor's ethic. I owe them, now I'm going to pay them back. The problem, though, with debtor's ethic is, what happens if the ledger of the debt in your mind has seemingly been paid? Or when the extent of what's being asked of you is greater than you think you otherwise should have to give. Therein lies the beginning of what comes resentment, anger, a sense of entitlement. I know that there are some adult kids who love their parents as a way to posture themselves with their elderly parents, that the elderly parents, when they die, might favor one child over another with their retirement, with what's given to them in a will. But even in a more virtuous way of being a very kind person who does any number of acts for others, as so many in this very room do, it begs the question, what happens if I ask you to serve another person repeatedly, time and 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 time again, and that person does not only not keep up with serving you back, but does not keep up in thanking you. In fact, at times, not only does not thank you or keep up, sometimes slanders you, complains about you. That's exactly what happens in local churches around the world. When we're called to love each other, but we have in our minds, if not in the back of our Bibles, a ledger that says, I'm keeping score on what I believe I deserve in response to what I have done. And God somehow, wonderfully, magically, mysteriously, wisely, doesn't let those other people keep up with your score to then beg the bigger question, why were you doing the right thing the entire time? Because at the end of the day, sometimes living for others can be just simply a means of living for yourself, either the appreciation or the reciprocation that you otherwise feel that you deserve, from parents to friends, even fellow Christians in the church. But Paul says here in verse 15, we should not live for ourselves, we should not live for others, says in verse 15, that those who live might live, no longer live for themselves, but for him who for their sake died and was raised. That's the irony of the wording picture here. In his death, we find a reason to live. In his sacrifice, we find direction for the decisions that we will now make, which is we live for Christ. The gift of redemption for us comes through Christ's death and resurrection, requires that we change the way that we not only live, but why we live. Think of it like this. Christ controls the reins of your heart. And I wonder how often those reins we have grabbed out of his hands to say we want to lead our lives in a different direction. We desire to live for the Lord. Now, here's the key. You can choose one way to live, but in choosing that way, live two different ways. And here's what I mean. You can live for Christ, and in doing so, you will live not for others, but for the good of others. There's a difference there. You will not live for others, but you'll live for the good of others. May I remind you, when the Pharisees came and tested Jesus, pop quiz on the Mosaic Law, what is the greatest commandment? Taking all 630 commands of the Mosaic Law, boiling down to the 10 commandments as we know them today, boiling down further, Jesus says, you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength, basically citing Deuteronomy chapter 6. And then he gives a bonus feature, and you shall love your neighbor as yourself. Which he would say in Matthew chapter 7, verse 12, do unto others as you'd have them do unto you. We live for Christ, which is seen in part by how we live for the good of others. Why is that an important distinction? Because living for the good of others, it puts a boundary marker, it puts a protective guard there. It's not, I'm not living for these people. I'm living for the good of these people. I live for Christ, which means no matter what happens, there's a backflow preventer that keeps their good or bad things happening to me to keep my heart from being protected. That's not why I was doing it to begin with. If that valve is broken in your life, then what will happen is it'll flow back into you and your life will become eventually bitter, resentful, self-righteous, or proud because you will see what others are doing by comparison to what you are doing and you'll think they're not doing what I'm doing and feel discouraged at best and resentful and bitter at worst. But if you live for Christ, which is what it's saying to Paul, which is what Paul's saying here, then you will finally live free. Now, why does this matter? Okay. Let's put this text back in its context. Paul's the writer, under the inspiration of the Holy Spirit, talking to a church that was planted by Paul, that he gave himself to be there for over a year and a half, planted, started the church, pastored them, loved them, cared for them, writes them in 1 Corinthians after having left them, learning about, man, this church that I've pastored, I wish I could have stayed longer, but I couldn't, but they've got a lot of issues. And so he addresses in 1 Corinthians all the issues that he has to deal with, their divisiveness, the sin in the church not being addressed, their spiritual immaturity with their spiritual gifts, the fact that they're being questioning, of, did the resurrection really take place? He is addressing them. And you think, okay, they got that letter. They will now have shaped up. He will have like, you know, kind of got, talk some sense to them and they'll be good to go. By the time 2 Corinthians comes on the scene, the second letter he writes to them, they're now questioning his apostleship. Other teachers have come after Paul and are basically saying, hey, Paul's not the real deal. We're the real deal. And so Paul in 2 Corinthians has to give a defense of his apostleship. Friends, let me just tell you something. If there's anybody who would have a history of having loved people, it would be Paul. And if there's anybody who would have a history of having loved people that did not love him back, it would be Paul. Back to verse 14, though, he says, the love of Christ controls us. So here's how you audit your questions. Remember the questions? Whom do you live for? You got to go back to verse 14. Who loves you? Who loves you? You go back to the gospel to motivate your life. Friends, I'm challenging each and every one of us here today. What does 2025 look like for you to be controlled by the love of Christ, protected from yourself, No longer living for yourself, but now living for Christ by how you live for the good of others. For some, that's non-Christian friends and coworkers who just need you to ask them out for lunch and have a conversation about their life and get to know them and ask them questions. Tell them, hey, I'm a Christian. One of the things I love doing as a Christian, I like to pray for people. How can I pray for you? Like literally copy and paste those exact words in your conversation. Talk to them about, man, I can relate to the struggles. This is what I have to deal with in my life. And look how God has changed me. It's his work still in me. And I hope to still even live more for him. But I'm thankful for how I'm committed to him. For others, it's not the non-Christian in your life. It's the Christians in your life. How are others going to be helped this year because of the decisions you're making this year for changes you want to implement? Things you want to learn. Some of you, for example, are going to be reading through the Bible in a year. Acknowledging, some of us start that and then you'll get to like Deuteronomy. And then we're like, well, I was 5 for 5. And then I kind of went downhill. It's okay. You're not saved by Bible reading. You're saved by grace through faith alone, Christ alone. But let's just take the idea of a Bible reading plan. Who is going to be better off in 2025 for you reading the Bible this year? Because as you get to know the God who has saved you and has communicated to you and just the amazing work of who he is and what he has done in history and in lives, but who is hearing that evidence and seeing that grace coming from you as you maybe text those encouraging words to somebody? I read this today. I thought of you. As I was reading this past week, I'm praying for you. As I see these examples, I'm motivated to serve you. Now, you might not introduce it that way to be seemingly so self-promoting and drawing people's attention to yourself with a neon billboard, but nevertheless, how is it that you live for Christ this coming year by living for the good of others? Your spouse, your children, your roommates, your parents, your siblings, your coworkers, your friends, your neighbors. For Paul, he's had to go back to being reminded Jesus died so that Paul could live. It's profound and it's true. Reflect on his death to find the purpose for your life. And in doing so, you will find direction for your days ahead, however long you have them.
Thank you for listening to audio from Grace Church Miami. May God draw you nearer to Him through His Word. If you'd like to check out more resources or donate to this ministry, please visit gracechurch.miami.